and she would not look away, and as if she had determined to down his look before she lowered her own bold eyes. But Wong the Tiger only stared on, indomitably, and without any anger visible, and with a mighty and calm patience, and for all his depth of anger he had a power of such strong patience, if he were not angry. As for the woman, she stared on for a long time, but at last, although he still stared unmoved, her eyelids fluttered, and she gave a cry, and turned, and she said to the guards, "Oh, take me away to the jail again," and she would not look at him any more. Then Wong the Tiger, smiling in the mirthless way he had, said to her, "You see, I said you have a new master." But she would not answer him anything. She stood suddenly drooping, and she parted her lips and panted a little, and at last he told the guards to take her away again, and this time she went without any struggle, glad to go away from him. Then Wong the Tiger was all the more curious to know who she was, and he was very curious to know how she came to be in the robber's lair, and he had it in his mind to know her story. So when the guard came back shaking his head and saying, "I've had wild ones in my hand in my day, but not like this tigress," Wong the Tiger said to him, "Tell the chief of the jail that I must know who she is and why she was in the lair." "She will not answer any question," said the guard. "No, she says nothing. The only change in her was that at first she would not eat, but now she eats ravenously, yet not as though she were hungry, but as though she ate to be strong for a purpose. But she will not tell anyone who she is. The women are curious, and they have tried every cunning way to question her, but she will not tell. Torture may force it from her, but even then I do not know, for she is so fierce and bitter a thing. Do you order torture, my general?" Wong the Tiger thought for a while then, and at last he set his teeth together, and he said, "If there is no other way, let it be by torture. She is to obey me, but it is not to be torture to her death." And after a while he said again, "And break none of her bones, and do not mar her skin." At the end of the day the guard came to him once more to make report, and he said in consternation, "My general, high above me, it is not possible to make that woman say anything, so long as we must torture her so gently as to break no bones, and not mar her skin. She laughs at us." Then Wong the Tiger looked at him gloomily, and he said, "Let her be for the time, then, and give her meats and some wine to eat and to drink." And he put the matter into the recesses of his mind, until he could think what to do with her. Then, while he waited for a thought to come to him, Wong the Tiger sent his trusty hair-lipped man southward to his old home, and he bade the man tell his brothers all that had befallen him, and how great his success was, and how he had won it and lost but a few men, and how he had entrenched himself in his region. He warned the man, however, saying, "You are not to boast too much of what I have done, for this small place and this little county seat is but the first step up the high mountain of glory before me, and you must not let my brothers think I am as high as I plan to go, or they will come hanging on me and beg me to foist up this son of theirs or that, and I want no more of their sons. No, even though I have not the son of my own, I wish I had. Tell them the small measure of my success, and tell it so that they will be encouraged to give me the monies I still need, for I have 5,000 men now to feed and clothe, and they eat like wolves. But tell them I have begun, and I shall go on until I have this province in my rule, and after that more provinces. There is no boundary to my way." To all this the trusty man gave his promise, and he went his way south dressed as a poor pilgrim who goes to worship at some distant temple. As for Wong the Tiger, he set himself then to the settling of his men, and it was true he had every right to take pride in what he had done. He had established himself honorably, and not as a common robber chief, and he was established in the magistrate's court and as part of the government of that country. And everywhere by river and lake his fame went forth through that region, and everywhere people spoke of the Tiger. And when he opened his lists for anyone to take service under him, as he did now, men flocked to his banners. But he chose them carefully, and he rejected the old and unfit, and such as looked weak or half-blind or imbecile. And he paid off such of the state soldiers as did not seem able or strong, and there were many of these who had been in the army merely to have food to eat. Thus Wong the Tiger gathered to himself a mighty army of nearly 8,000 men, all young and strong and fit for war. He took the 100 he had in the beginning, except the few who had been killed in the brawl with the robbers or who had been burned in the lair, and these he raised into captains and sergeants over the new men. But when all this was done, Wang the Tiger did not, as many men in his place would have done, sit in idleness and ease to eat and drink. No, he made himself rise early, even in the winter, and he taught and trained his men, and he forced them to learn every skill of war and battle that he knew himself, and how to feint and to attack and to ambush, and how to retreat without loss. Everything he could, he made up his mind he would teach them, for he had no purpose to stay forever in this small court of a county magistrate. No, his dreams were swelling in him, and he let them grow as great as they would. Chapter 15. Now the two elder brothers of Wang the Tiger had been waiting with hearty impatience to hear how he did with his venture, but each brother showed it in his own way. Wang the eldest, since his son had hanged himself, pretended to have no more interest in his brother, and he mourned his son whenever he thought of him. His lady did also, but her mourning found comfort in complaining against her husband, and she said often, "I said from the first he ought not to go. I said from the first that it was an ill thing for a family like ours to send so good a son for a soldier. It is a low, common life, and I said so." At first Wang the eldest had been foolish enough to make answer to her, and to say, "Now, lady, I did not know you were unwilling, and it seemed to me you were ready enough, the more because he was to be no common soldier, but my brother would raise him as he raised himself." But this lady had made up her mind as to what she had said, and she cried out vehemently, "You never do know what I say, because your mind is always on something else, some woman or other, I suppose. I said plainly and often that he ought not to go. And what is your brother but a common soldier? If you would listen to me, our son would have been living and well today, and he was our best son and framed to be a scholar. But I have never listened to in my own house." She sighed and made a piteous face, and Wang the eldest looked east and west, and he was very uneasy to have called this storm on himself, and he did not answer a word, hoping that the force of her anger would spend itself more quickly thus. The truth was that now her son was dead, the lady continually moaned that he had been her best son after all, although when he lived she scolded him too, and found fault with him, and thought her eldest son the best by much. But now the eldest was not good enough for her in anything, and so the dead son seemed better. There was that third and hunchbacked one, but she never asked for him, after she heard he liked to live with Pear Blossom, as he now did wholly, and she said if anyone spoke of him, "He is not strong, and the country air is good for him." She sent a little present to Pear Blossom sometimes in lieu of thanks, some small, useless thing or other, a little bowl of flowered pottery, or a bit of cheap cloth, only partly silk, but brave in show or color, such as Pear Blossom never wore. But Pear Blossom always thanked her prettily, whatever the gift, and sent back fresh eggs or some produce of the land, careful always to return something and so owe nothing. Then she took the cloth and gave it to the fool, or she made a gay coat or shoes to please the poor thing, and she gave the pottery bowl to the hunchback if he liked it, or to the farmer's wife who lived there in the earthen house, if she fancied the flowery town stuff more than her own blue and white wear. As for Wang the Second, he waited in his own way to hear what his younger brother did, and he listened secretly here and there, and he heard rumors that the robber chief to the north of them had been killed by a new young brave. But he did not know if it were true or not, or if the brave were his brother or not. So he waited and saved his money until the trusty man came, and he sold Wang the Tiger's lands when he could do it prudently, and he put the money out at very high interest. And if he turned the money over a time or two more than he told anyone, this he considered his just wage for all the trouble he had for his brother. And he did no injury to his brother thus, for no one else would have done as well as he did for Wang the Tiger. But on the day when the hare-lipped, trusty man stood upon the threshold, Wang the Tiger could scarcely wait to hear his tale. And with an unused eagerness upon his face, he drew the trusty man into his own room and poured tea out for him. And then the trusty man told what he had to say, and Wang the Second heard it through to the end without a word. When it was finished, and the trusty man told it exactly and well, and he ended as Wang the Tiger had told him to end, saying, "Your brother and my general says we are not to be hasty, and say he has climbed his mountain because this is but his first step, and he holds but a small county seat, and he dreams of provinces." Then Wang the Second drew his breath in a little, and he asked, "But do you think he is sure enough so that I can safely risk my own silver on him?" Then the trusty man answered, Your brother is a very clever man, and many a man would have been content to settle into the robber's lair and maraud the region and so raise somewhat high. But your brother is too wise for that, knowing that a robber must turn respectable before he can be a king, and so he has the power of state behind him. Yes, although it is only a small magistrate's seat, still it is the state, and he is a state's general. And when he goes out to fight with other lords of war, and when he finds a cause of quarrel with someone, as he will when the spring comes, then he can go out as one with authority, and not as rebel. Such caution as this pleased Wang the Second very much, and so he said with more than usual heartiness, the hour being near to noon, "Come out and eat and drink with us, if you will bear our common meal." And he took the man with him, and set him at their family table. Then when Wang the Second's wife saw the trusty man, she cried a greeting to him in her hearty way, and she said, "What news of my little pocked son?" The trusty man rose to his feet then, and answered that her son was very well, and he did well, and the general was minded to raise him up, doubtless, for he kept him always about his person. But before he could say a word, the woman shouted that he was to sit and not stand in courtesy. So when he had sat down again, he thought to tell them about how the lad had gone to the robber's lair, and how tricky he was, and how neatly he had done what he had to do. But he stopped himself, because he knew that women are so strange, and their tempers are uncertain, and mothers are the strangest of all, for they see fears and harms about their children where there are no such things. He contented himself with silence, therefore, when he had said enough to please her. In a few minutes she had forgotten all she asked, for she was busy about many things, and she bustled here and there, fetching bowls and setting them out on the table, and she held a babe at her breast as she worked. The child suckled tranquilly, while with her free arm she was zealous in dipping out food to the guest, and to her husband, and to the clamoring, hungry children who did not eat at the table, but stood at the door or on the street with their bowls and chopsticks, and when their bowls were empty they came running in for fresh rice and vegetables and meats. When the meal was over, and they had finished their tea after they ate, Wang the Second took the trusty man to his elder brother's gate, and there he bade the man wait until he could call his brother out, and then they would go to a tea-house to talk. But he told the man not to show himself, lest the lady see him, and they would need to go and hear her talk for a time. And so saying, Wang the Second went inside, and threw a cord or two to his elder brother's own rooms. And there he found him lying fast asleep on a couch beside a brazier of red coals, snoring after his noon meal. But when Wang the eldest felt his brother's light touch on his arm, he started out of his sleep with a snort, and after being dazed for a while, he understood what was wanted, and he struggled up and drew on the fur robes he had laid aside, and he followed his brother softly so that he would not be heard. No one saw them go out except his pretty concubine, who thrust her head out of a door to see who passed, and Wang the eldest held up his hand as a sign of silence, and she let him go. For if she were timid and fearful of the lady, she was a kind, mild creature too, and she could lie kindly, and she would say she had not seen him, if she were asked. They went together to the tea-house, and there the trusty man told his story over again, and Wang the eldest groaned in his heart that he had not a son to give his younger brother, and he was jealous that his second brother's son did so well. But he kept it to himself for once, and he only spoke well to the man, and he agreed to all his brother said in the matter of monies to be sent back, and he waited until he reached his home again. Then suddenly it seemed as though his heart overflowed with jealousy, and he went and sought out his eldest son. The young man lay in the curtained bed in his own room, and he lay there idle and flushed and reading a loose, lascivious tale called The Three Fair Women, and he started when he saw his father come in, and he hid the book under his robe. But his father did not even see it, he was so full of what he had come to say, and began in haste, "Son, do you still wish to go to be with your uncle and rise with him to a high place?" But the young man had outgrown that moment in his life, and now he yawned delicately, and his mouth was as pretty and pink as a girl's when he opened it thus, and he looked at his father and smiled idly, and he said, "Was I ever so foolish as to want to go for a soldier?" "But you will not be a soldier," urged his father anxiously. "You will be from the first much higher than soldier, and next your uncle." Then he lowered his voice, coaxing his son. "Your uncle is a general already, and he has established himself by the wisest guile I ever heard of, and the worst is over." But the young man shook his head willfully, and Wang the eldest, half angered and half helpless, looked at his son lying there on his bed. Some truthful sight came to this man at this instant, and he saw his son for what he was, a young man dainty and fastidious and idle, without any single ambition for anything except his pleasure, and his only fear that he was not better dressed and less in fashion than other young men whom he knew. Yes, Wang the eldest saw his son lying on the silken quilts of his bed, and the young man wore silk to his very skin, and he had satin shoes on his feet, and his skin was like a beauty's skin, oiled and perfumed, and his hair was perfumed and smoothed with some foreign oil also. For the young man studied to make his body beautiful in every way, and well nigh he worshipped it for its softness and beauty, and his reward was that there were many who praised him for it among those whom he played with at night in gaming houses and playhouses. Yes, he was a young lord in a rich man's house, as anyone could see, and none would have dreamed that his grandfather was one Wang Lung, a farmer and a man of the earth. For this one instant did Wang the eldest see his eldest son, although he was a man muddled and confused with many small things, and he was frightened for his son, and he cried out in a high voice very different from his usual rolling tones, "I am afraid for you, my son! I am afraid you will come to no good end!" Then he cried out more sharply than he ever had to this son of his, "I say you shall go and hew out some sort of a way of life, and not grow old here in idle, slothful pleasure." And he wished in a sort of fright, which he did not understand in himself, that they had seized on the moment of the lad's ambition. But it was too late. The moment was gone. When the young man heard the unwanted sound of his father's voice, he cried out, half afraid, half petulant, sitting up suddenly in his bed, "Where is my mother? I will go and ask my mother if she will have me go or not, and I will see if she is so anxious to be rid of me." But Wang the eldest, hearing this, fell back into himself again, and he said hastily and peaceably,
Well, let be. You shall do as you please, since you are my eldest."
And the cloud descended upon him again, and the moment of clarity was gone. He sighed and thought to himself that it was true that young lords could not be as other common youths were, and he said to himself that it was true his brother's wife was a very common woman, and doubtless his pocked son was little better than a servant to his uncle. So Wang the eldest consoled himself vaguely, and he shuffled as he went out from his son's room. As for the young man, he lay back on his silk-covered pillow again, and he clasped his hands under his head and smiled his indolent smile. And after a while he felt for the book he had hidden, and took it out and began to read it ardently once more, for it was a naughty, zestful book that a friend of his had commended to him. But Wang the eldest could not forget his vague despondency, and it hung on him still, so that for the first time his life did not seem so good to him as he thought it was. It was a very sore thing to him, that when he had seen the trusty man gone again, his pilgrim's wallet filled with silver, and his belt stiff with silver about his waist, and his bundle filled with it, so that he could hardly heave the thing to his back, that he could not think of anything Wang the tiger could do for him yet. And it seemed a sore thing to him, and his life very weary, because he had no son to whom he could look for glory, and he had nothing but his land that he hated, and yet he did not dare to part with it altogether. His lady even saw his despondency, and in his extremity he told her some of his trouble, and she had taught him so well that in his secret heart he did believe her wiser than himself, although he would have denied it stoutly if anyone had asked him if he did. But this time she gave him no help, for when he tried to tell her how great his younger brother had become, she laughed shrilly and with scorn, and she said, "A general at a small county seat is no great lord of war, my poor old man, and you are silly to be so envious of him. When he is lord of war in the province, it will be time enough to tell off our younger son to him, and more likely it will be your smallest son, who is only a suckling now at the other's breast." So Wang the eldest sat silent then, and for a time he did not go out as zestfully as he had to his pleasure places, and not even talk with as many friends seemed the worth it had before. No, he sat alone, and he was not one to sit thus either, for he was a man who liked to be where there were people running to and fro in a commotion of some sort or other, even though it were but household bustle and servants bickering with a vendor, and children crying and quarreling and the usual uproar of daily living. He liked even this better than to sit alone. But now he sat alone because he was wretched, and he did not know why he was, except that for the first time it came to him that he was not so young as he was once, and his age was creeping on him unawares. And it seemed to him he had not found the good in life he might have found, and he was not so great as he should have been. Chiefest of all his vague miseries was one not vague, and it was the land he had from his father. It was a curse to him, for it was his only livelihood, and he must give it some oversight, or he would have nothing to eat, he and his children, and his wives and servants. And it seemed to him as though there were some vile magic in that land, and it was always seed time, and he must go out to it, or time to fertilize, and he must see to it, or it was harvest, and he must stand in the hot sun and measure out grain, or it was time to collect his rents. And there was all the hateful round of the land, forcing him to labor when he was by nature a man of leisure and a lord. Yes, even though he had an agent, there was some shrewdness in this man, even against his will, that made his gorge rise to think the agent grew rich at his expense, so that although he hated it, he dragged himself each season to the place where he could oversee what was done. He sat now in his own room, and now under a tree in the court outside, if the winter sun were warm enough, and he groaned to think how he must go out year after year, or the robbers who rented his land from him would give him nothing. Yes, they were forever howling, "Ah, we have had floods this year," and "Ah, we have such a drought as never was," or else it was, "This is the year for locusts." And they and his agents had 100 tricks against him who was their landlord, and for the weariness of his strife with them he blamed and he loathed the land. He longed for the day when Wong the Tiger would be great enough so that his elder brother need no longer go out in heat and cold. He longed for the day when he could say, "I am brother to Wong the Tiger," and it would suffice. Once it had seemed much that men had come to call him Wong the Landlord, for this was his name now, and it had seemed an honorable good name until this moment. The truth was this, that Wong the Landlord found it very hard, because all his life, so long as his father Wong Lung had lived, he had received money freely from him enough to pay for all he needed, and he never labored over its coming. But after the inheritance was divided, he labored more than he ever had, and yet with all this labor to which he was unaccustomed, he had not all the silver he needed, and his sons and wives never seemed to care how he labored. No, his sons would wear the very best, and they must have this fur in the winter and that dainty light fur to line their robes in the spring and autumn, and all kinds of silks each in its season. And it was a hardship fit to break their hearts if they must wear a coat a little too long or a little wider in the cut than was this year's fashion, for they feared more than anything the laughter of the young town dandies who were their companions. So with the eldest son, and now the fourth son was learning this also. Although he was but 13 years old, he must have his little robes cut thus, and so, and a ring on his finger, and his hair scented and oiled, too, and a maid to serve him only, and a man to take him out. And because he was his mother's darling, and she feared for him at the hands of evil spirits, he wore a gold ring in one ear, too, to deceive the gods and make them think him a girl and worthless. As for his lady, Wong the Landlord could never persuade her that there was less silver in the house than there had once been. And if he said when she wanted a sum of him, "But I have not so much to give you, and I can only give you 50 pieces now," she would cry out, "I have promised it to the temple for a new roof over a certain god, and if I do not give it, I shall lose my dignity. Indeed, you have it, for I know you spend money like water on whining and gaming and on all those low women I know you have, and I am the only one in this whole house who looks to the things of the soul and to gods. Some day I may have to pray your soul out of hell, and you will be sorry I had not the silver then." So Wong the Landlord had somehow to find the silver, although he hated it very much to see his good money going into the hands of the smooth and secret priests whom he hated and did not trust, and of whom he heard certain very evil things. Yet he could never be sure, either, that they had not some knowledge of magic, and he could never be sure, although he pretended disbelief in gods as things fit only for women, that there was not some power in them too. And this was another confusion in him. The truth was that this lady of his was so deep now in her intimacy with gods and temples and all such things that she grew very holy, and she spent many hours in going to this god and that, and it gave her the greatest pleasure to pass into a temple gate, leaning as a great lady does upon her maids. And as she came in to see the priests of the temple, and even the abbot, come to her obsequious and bowing, and full of flattery and full of talk, that she was a favorite of the gods and a lay nun, and very near the way. When they talked thus, she simpered and smiled and cast her eyes down and deprecated. But before she well knew what she did, oftentimes she had promised them this and that and a sum of money more than she really wished to give. But the priests took care to give her full praise, and they put her name up in many places as an example to all devout persons. And one temple even presented her with a wooden ensign painted vermilion red, and there were gilt letters on it signifying how this lady was so devout and good a follower of the gods. This ensign was hung in a lesser hall of the temple, but where many might see it. After this she was the more proud and holy and devout in her looks, and she studied to sit calmly always, and to fold her hands, and often she went holding her rosary, and muttering the syllables of her prayer while others gossiped or talked idly. Therefore, being so holy, she was very hard with her husband, and she would have what silver she needed to keep up the name she had. When Wong, the landlord's younger wife, saw what the lady had, she wanted her little share too. Not for the gods, although the girl learned to prate of them to please the lady. But still she wanted her silver. And Wong, the landlord, could not think what she did with it, because she did not dress herself in fine flowered silks, or buy jewels and gold things for her dress and hair. Yet the money went from her quickly, too, and Wong, the landlord, did not complain lest the girl go and weep before the lady, and the lady reproach him that since he had taken such a one, he ought to pay her something. For these two women liked each other in some strange, cool way, and they stood together against their husband if they wanted something for themselves. One day, Wong, the landlord, did find out the truth, however, for he saw his younger wife slip out to a side gate and take something from her bosom and give it to one who stood there. And Wong, the landlord, peered, and he saw the man was her old father. Then was Wong, the landlord, very bitter, and he thought to himself, "So I am feeding that old rascal and his family, too." And he went into his own room and sat and sighed and was very bitter for a while, and he groaned to himself. But it was no use, and he could do nothing, for if she chose to give what she had from her husband to her father, and not to spend it on sweetmeats and clothing and such things as most women love, she had this right, except that a woman ought to cleave first to the house of her husband. But Wong, the landlord, did not feel he could contend with her, and he let it pass. And Wong, the landlord, was the more torn in himself, for he could not control his own desires, even though he did now honestly try for the first time in his life when he was nearly 50 years old, to spend less for his love of women. But he had his weakness with him yet, and he could not bear to be thought a niggard among them when his fancy fixed itself. Besides these two women in his house, he had the singing girl established as a transient wife by common agreement in another part of the city. But she was a pretty leech, and although he had finished with her soon, she held him by her threats of killing herself and of loving him above all the world, and she cried on his bosom and fixed her little sharp fingers into the deep flesh on his neck, and she hung to him so that he did not know what to do with her. With her she had her old mother also, a vile hag, and she in her turn screeched out, "How can you cast off my daughter who has given you all? How would she live now, seeing that she has not been in a playhouse all these years you have had her, and her voice is gone, and others have taken her place? No, I will defend her, and I will take her case to the magistrate if you cast her off." This frightened Wong, the landlord, very much, for he feared the laughter of the town against him if they heard all this old woman's ribald talk that she would vent against him in court if she could, so that he fumbled hastily for what silver he had. When the two women saw he was afraid, they plotted and made every opportunity they could for storm and weeping, knowing that when they did, he would pay them in haste. And the strangest thing of all was that with so many troubles, this great, fat, weak man still could not keep himself free, but must still be overcome with his desires at a feast somewhere, and pay a new little singing girl he saw. Even though when he came home and was himself on the next day, he groaned at his own folly and cursed his own fulsome heart. But now, pondering all this during these weeks of his despondency, he grew frightened at his own zestlessness, and he did not even care to eat so much as he had. And when he found his appetite for food waning, he was frightened lest he die too soon, and he said to himself that he must rid himself of some of his troubles. And he determined that he would sell a good large share of his land and live on the silver, and he thought to himself secretly that he would spend what was his, and his sons must care for themselves if there was not enough left for their lifetime. And it seemed to him suddenly that it was a vain thing for a man to stint himself for those who live on after him. He rose willfully then, and he went to his second brother, and he said, "I am not fitted for the cares of a landlord's life, for I am a city man, a man of leisure. No, I cannot with my increasing weight and years go out at seed time and harvest, and if I do one day I shall drop dead with the heat or the cold. I have not lived with common people either, and they cheat me before I know it, and out of all my land and my labor. Now, this I ask of you. Act as my agent, and sell a good half of my lands for me now, and let me have the money as I need it, and what I do not need put out at interest for me, and let me be free of this accursed land. The other half I will keep to leave to my sons, but there is not one of them who will help me with it now. And when I say to my eldest son that he is to go for me sometimes to the land, he is always pressed with a meeting with some friend, or he has a headache, and we shall starve if we continue as we are now. Only the tenants grow rich from the land." Then Wang the second looked at this brother of his, and he despised him in his heart, but he said smoothly, "I am your brother, and I will not take any commission at all for selling it, and I will sell it for you to anyone who bids highest for it. But you must say what your lowest price is for each lot." But Wang the landlord was very eager to be finished with his land, and he said quickly, "You are my brother, and sell it for what you think fair. Shall I not trust my own brother?" He went away then in high good humor, because he was rid of half of his burden, and he could go his way for a time and wait for silver to come into his hands as he longed to do again. But he did not tell his lady what he had done, because she might cry out against him that he had given them over into the other's hand, and she would say that if he wished to sell, he ought to sell it himself to some among the many rich men with whom he feasted, and with whom he seemed in such deep friendship. And Wang the landlord did not wish to do this, for in his heart, for all his bluster, he trusted his brother's wit more than he did his own. And now, having done this, his heart rose again, and he could eat once more. And once more his life seemed good enough to him, and he thought to himself there were others more troubled than he, and he was ardent again. Now Wang the second grew more content than ever, for he had all in his own hands. He planned that he would buy the best of his brother's lands for himself. It was true that he paid a fair price for them, for he was not a dishonest man, as men are reckoned. And indeed he told his elder brother that he bought a little of the best land to keep it in the family. But how much of the land he bought Wang the landlord did not know, for Wang the second had him sign the deeds when he was somewhat drunken, and he did not look to see what name was on it. But being full of the good humor of drunkenness, his brother seemed excellent to him, and wholly to be trusted. He would not have been willing had he known to see so much of his land pass into Wang the second's keeping, perhaps. And so Wang the second made much of the poorer pieces he sold to tenants, or to whom it was who wished to buy. And it was true that Wang the second did sell much land thus. But Wang Lung had been very wise in his day, and he bought far more good land than any other kind. And so when all the business was over, Wang the second had in his personal possession, and for his sons, the best and the choicest of all his father's land, for he had so bought the best of the younger brother's inheritance also. And with all this land he planned he would supply much of the grain to his own markets, and increase his stores of silver and gold, and he grew powerful in the town and in that region, and men called him Wang the Merchant. But unless he knew it, no one would have dreamed this small, meager man was so rich, for Wang the Merchant still ate the plain, spare bit of food he always did, and took no new wife into his house as most men will when they are rich, for show, if for nothing else, and he wore the same sort of small patterned silk gown of a dark slate gray that he had always worn. In his house they added no new furniture, and in his courts there was no flower nor any waste thing, and what had been there before now was dead, for his wife was thrifty and raised flocks of fowls, and these ran in and out of the rooms to pick up bits of food the children dropped, and they ran about the courts and plucked every grass blade and green leaf, so that the courts were bare except for a few old pines, and the earth grew hard and packed. Nor would Wang the merchant let his sons be spendthrift nor idle. No, he planned for each one, and each had a few years of schooling to learn to read and write and to count skillfully upon the abacus. But he would not let them stay long enough to be held scholars in any wise, for scholars will not labor at anything. And he planned apprenticeships for them, and they were to come into his business. The pocked one he considered his younger brothers, and the next one he planned to make his steward on the land. But the others he apprenticed when their time came, and when each was 12 years old. In the earthen house, Pear Blossom lived on with the two children, and every day of her life was like the one before it, and she asked no more than that it should be so always. She grieved no more for the land, for if she did not see the elder, she saw the younger son of her dead lord come out before harvest time, to estimate the growth of grain, and to see the seed weighed off and all such things. Yes, and she heard, too, how Wong the merchant, for all he was a townsman, was sharper as landlord than his brother even, for he knew to a 10 catty weight what a field still standing in green grain would give, and his narrow little eyes were always sharp to see if a tenant pressed his foot secretly against the side of a load to weigh it down, or if he poured water into the rice or the wheat to make it swell. His years in the grain market had taught him everything that country people do to cheat the merchant and the townsman, for they are enemies by nature. But if Pear Blossom asked whether any ever saw him angry when he found out a trick, the answer always came with unwilling admiration that he was never angry. No, he was only implacable and calm and more clever than any of them, and the nickname he had in that whole countryside was this: He Who Wins in Every Bargain. It was a scornful name and full of hatred, and all the country people hated Wong the merchant very heartily. But he did not care, and he was even pleased to know what they called him. And he knew because an angry farm wife shouted it at him once with curses when he saw her sink a great round stone into the heart of a basket of grain about to be weighed, and she had done it when she thought his back was turned. More than a time or two did a farm woman curse him, for a bitter-tongued woman is bolder than any man, and if a man were discovered in a trick, he looked sullen or sheepish, as his nature was, but a woman would curse, and she would cry out after him, "How is it that in one generation you forget how your father and your mother toiled on the land, even as we do, and they starved, too, as we must, when you grind our blood and bones as you do now?" Wong the landlord had grown afraid sometimes when the people grew bitter, for he knew the rich may well fear the poor, who seem so patient and humble, and who can be so bold and ruthless when they turn to rend whom they hate. But Wong the merchant feared nothing. And it was nothing to him even when one day Pear Blossom saw him pass, and she called to him, and came out and said, "If so be, sir, my lord's son, that you can be a little less exact with the people, I should be glad. They labor very hard, and they are poor and like children in ignorance oftentimes. It goes against my heart to hear the cruel things they say sometimes about my lord's sons." But Wong the merchant only smiled and went his way. It was nothing to him what any said or did, so long as he had his full profits. His was the power, and he feared nothing, for he felt himself secure in his riches. Chapter 16. Now the winter wore on very long and cold in those parts, and in the time of bitter winds and in the fury of wind-driven snows, Wong the Tiger could but stay on in the magistrate's courts in the place that was now his, and wait for the spring to come. He entrenched himself in his place, and he steadily demanded from the magistrate this tax and that for his 8,000 soldiers. Yes, there was even a tax put on all the land for his benefit, and it was called the tax for the protection of the people by the state soldiery. But this soldiery was really Wong the Tiger's own private army, and he taught them and trained them, and made them ready to enlarge his power for him when he saw the moment was come. Every farmer in that whole region paid something on every field he had, and he paid it out for Wong the Tiger. And because the robbers were gone and the lair burned and they need not fear the leopard any more, the common folk were full of praise for Wong the Tiger, and they were ready to pay him well. But still they did not know how well this was. There were other taxes also that Wong the Tiger had the magistrate lay for him, some on shops and markets, and every traveler who came through that town, which was a pass between north and south, paid a tax, and every merchant paid a tax on the goods he took back and forth for sale and barter, and so the money poured steadily and secretly into Wong the Tiger's stores. He was sharp enough, too, to see that it did not touch too many hands in passing, knowing that no hand in this world will readily release as much silver as it grasps. He appointed his own trusty men to see to the collecting of it, and although these spoke smoothly to all and he commanded them so to speak, yet he gave them the power over anyone they found taking more than his share, and he told each trusty man that he would punish them himself if they failed him. He was safer than most from treachery, for everyone feared him for a ruthless man. Yet they knew him to be just, too, and they knew he did not kill any man carelessly or for mere pleasure. But as Wong the Tiger waited for the winter to be gone, he chafed very much in spite of his success, for this life in the magistrate's courtyards did not suit him. No, and there were none who could be his friends, for he would not bring himself to intimacy with any, knowing that as long as people feared him, he could hold his place the more easily among them. Besides, he was one who did not by nature love to take part in feasting and friendship, and he lived alone except for his pocked nephew, whom he kept near him always, lest he need something, and his trusty hair-lipped man, who was his chief guard. The truth was that now the magistrate was so old and given to his opium pipe, everything ran slackly about him, and his courts were filled with cliques and jealousies, and crowded with underlings and underlings' relatives who sought an easy way to live. This man turned against that, and there were deep angers and revenges and quarrels continually. But if these were brought to the old magistrate's ears, he turned himself to his opium, or he thought of something else. For well he knew he could not settle everything, and he lived alone with his old wife in an inner court, and he only came out when he must. But he tried to do his state duty still, and every audience day at dawn he rose and put on his official robes, and he went into his audience hall and ascended the dais there, and sat down in the chair from whence he heard his cases. He did his poor best, too, for he was a good and kind man at heart, and he supposed he meted out justice to such as came before him there. But he did not know that every suppliant who came before him had paid his way through from the very gate man at the gates, so that any man who had not silver enough for high and low could not hope even to reach that audience hall. And the very counselors who stood in the presence of the magistrate had each received his share. Nor did the old magistrate know he leaned so heavily on these counselors of his. No, for he was old and easily confused, and often he did not catch the point of a case, and he was ashamed to say he did not, or he dozed somewhat toward the end of the hour, and did not hear what was said, and he was afraid to ask again, lest men think him not able. So he turned naturally to his counselors, who never failed to flatter him, and when they said, "Ah, this man is evil, and that man has the right of it," the old magistrate would agree hastily and say, "It is what I thought, it is what I thought." And when they cried out, "Such an one ought to be well beaten because he is so lawless," the old magistrate would quaver forth, "Yes, yes, let him be beaten." Now in these idle days, Wong the Tiger often went to the audience hall to see and to hear and to pass the time away. And when he went, he sat to one side, and his trusty men and his pocked nephew stood about him as a guard. Thus he heard and saw all this injustice. At first he said to himself that he would pay no heed to any of these things, for he was a lord of war, and these civil affairs were no business of his. And he would spend his care on his soldiers, seeing that they did not share in the loose, idle life of the courts. And many a time when he saw that which made him angry in the audience hall, he went out and was furious with his soldiers, and forced them to marches and practices of war, whatever the winds were that day, and so he relieved his heart of the pressure of its anger. But he was a man just at heart, and when he saw the injustice go on time after time, he could not bear it at last, and he grew surcharged with anger against some of the counselors who had the ear of the magistrate, and especially against the chief counselor. Yet he knew it was no use to say anything to the weak old man. But still, when he had sat sometimes and listened to cases, and when he had seen injustice done 100 times, he grew so pent in himself that he would rise and stride away, and he muttered to himself many times, "If spring does not come quickly, I shall kill someone against my will." As for the counselors, they did not love him either, because he secured so much revenue, and they mocked him for a coarsely bred fellow, and one beneath them in polish and learning. Now Wong the Tiger's anger burst forth one day in a sudden way that he himself had not expected, and it began with a small matter even as a mighty storm will begin sometimes with only a little wind and a handful of ragged cloud. It happened on a certain day before the new year, when men are out everywhere to collect debts and those who owe hide as best they may, so that they cannot be found until the first day of the new year, when debts cannot be collected from anyone, that the old magistrate had his last audience day of the old year, and he sat upon his dais. On that day Wong the Tiger had been very restless because he was so idle. He would not game because he did not want his soldiers to see him at it, and feel the more free themselves to do it. And he could not read over much because novels and tales weaken a man. They are so full of dreams and the stuffs of love. And he was not scholar enough for the old philosophies. Therefore, being sleepless also, he rose and went with his guard and sat a while in the audience room to see who would come that day. But in his heart he was pent and impatient for the spring, and especially because the last 10 days had been so cold and so filled with a downpour of constant rain that his men cried out against being taken out of their quarters. There he sat, and it seemed to him that his was the dreariest life, and there was not one soul to care if he lived or died, and so he sat, listless and glowering in his usual place. Presently he saw a certain rich man come in whom he knew, having seen him here before. This man was a usurer of the town, a smooth-faced, fat man, with very small, smooth, yellow hands that he flourished with a sort of evil grace as he spoke, and he continually pushed back his long, silken sleeves from his hands before he waved them. Many times Wong the Tiger had watched his hands and seen how small they were and how soft and full and how pointed the fingertips were with their long nails, and he had watched the man's hands when he did not hear what he said, even. But today the usurer came in with a poor farmer, and the farmer was very frightened and ill at ease, and he threw himself before the magistrate with his face to the ground, and remained there speechless, begging for mercy. Then the usurer told his case, and it was that he had loaned a sum of money to this farmer, and had accepted his land as security. This was 2 years ago, and now the money with its interest had mounted above the worth of the land. "Yet in spite of this," the usurer cried, and he pushed back his silken sleeves and moved his smooth hands and made his voice rich and reproachful, and he was very unctuous. "In spite of this, O honored magistrate, he will not move from his land." And the man rolled his little eyes around in indignation at this wicked farmer. But the farmer said nothing at all. He continued to kneel there with his face bent and leaning upon his two hands forked together. At last the old magistrate asked him, "Why did you borrow, and why do you not pay?" Then the farmer looked up a little, and he fixed his eyes on the magistrate's footstool, and he continued to kneel, and he said anxiously, "Sir, I am a very common man and poor, and I do not know how to speak to such as you, honored sir. I am very common, and I have never spoken to one higher than the head in our village, and I do not know how to speak here, and yet I have no one to speak for me, seeing that I am so poor." Then the old magistrate said kindly enough, "You need not fear, only speak on." Then the farmer, after opening his lips a time or two soundlessly, began to speak, but still he did not lift his eyes at all, and it could be seen that his spare body was shivering in his patched and ragged clothes, from which the old wadding stuck forth out of the holes like old sheep's wool. His feet were bare and thrust only into shoes woven out of reeds, and these had now fallen from his feet, so that his hard and horny toes rested stiffly upon the damp stone floor. But he did not seem to feel this, and he began in a weak voice, and he said, "Sir, I had a little land from my father's. It is very poor land, and it has never fed us full. But my parents died early, and there were only I and my wife, and if we starved we did it, and that was all. But she bore a child, a son, and then after years another, a girl. When they were little it was still not so hard, but they grew and we had to wed the son, and his wife had a child. Sir, think of it. The land was not enough for my wife and me, and now we have these. The girl was long too young to be wed, and I had her to feed somehow. 2 years ago I had a chance to betroth her to an old man in a village near us, for his wife was dead, and he needed one to mend his household. But I had to give her a wedding garment. Sir, I had nothing, so I borrowed a little money, only 10 pieces of silver, to most men nothing, but to me very much and more than I had. I borrowed it from this usurer. In less than a year the 10 pieces had grown into 20 of its own accord, for I had no more than the 10 to spend. Now in 2 years it is 40. Sir, how can dead silver grow like that? There is only my land. He says, 'Go,' but where shall I go? Let him come and drive me off, I say. There is nothing else than this." When the man had finished saying this, he remained perfectly silent. Wong the Tiger stared at him, and it was the strangest thing that he could not keep his eyes from the man's feet. The farmer's face was drawn and sallow, and told of his life and of his never being full fed since he was born. But his feet told the whole tale. There was something eloquent in this man's two bare feet, knotted and gnarled in the toes, and the soles like the dried hide of a water buffalo. Yes, looking at the man's feet, Wong the Tiger felt something welling up in him. Nevertheless, he waited to see what the old magistrate would say. Now this usurer was a man of the town and well known, and he had feasted with the magistrate many times, and he kept the goodwill of the court with him because he paid silver to high and low in every case he had, and he had many. The magistrate hesitated, therefore, although it could be seen he was somewhat moved, too. At last he turned to his chief counselor, a man near his own age but strong and straight for his years, and his face was smooth and handsome still, although his scanty whiskers that grew in three parts from his cheeks and chin were white. The magistrate asked this man,
"What do you say, my brother?"
This man smoothed his few white whiskers then, and he said slowly, as though he pondered justice, but the memory of silver was warm on his palm,
"It cannot be gainsaid that this farmer did borrow money, and he has not returned it, and money borrowed must run into interest, and this is according to the law. The usurer lives by his loaned monies, as a farmer does by his land. If the farmer rented his land out and received no rent, he would complain, and his complaint would be just. Yet this is only what the usurer has done. It is just, therefore, that he be paid his due."
The old magistrate listened to this carefully, nodding his head from time to time, and it could be seen he was moved by it too. But now, suddenly, the farmer lifted his eyes, and for the first time he looked in a kind of daze from one face to the other. Yet Wong the Tiger did not see his face or how his eyes looked. He only saw the man's two old, bare feet curl upon each other in an agony, and suddenly he could not bear it. His immense anger rushed forth, and he stood up. He clapped his hands together hard, and he roared in a great voice,
"I say the poor man shall have his land."
When all the people gathered in the court heard this roar come out of Wong the Tiger, every head turned toward him, and the trusty men Wong the Tiger had leaped to him and stood with their guns pointed fiercely, and seeing them, everyone shrank back and kept silent. But Wong the Tiger felt his anger released now, and he could not stay it if he would, and he pointed his finger at the usurer and stabbed it through the air again and again as he spoke, and he shouted in a great voice, his black brows darting now up, now down above his eyes,
"Again and again have I seen this fat, biting insect here with some tail like this, and he has greased his way in with silver to high and low. I am weary of him. Away with him!"
And he turned to his guard and shouted,
"After him with your guns!"
Now when the people heard this, they thought Wong the Tiger had gone suddenly mad, and everyone turned and ran for his life. Yes, and swiftest of all to run was the fat usurer, and he reached the gate ahead of them all, and he went through it with a squeak like a rat that barely escapes. He was so swift, and he knew so well the winding alleys, that although the trusty men pursued him, he was gone, and they could not find him. And when they had run so far, they could only draw themselves up and look at each other with blank faces and pant a while. And after they had looked a little more, they went back through the hubbub that had risen now in the streets. When they reached the court again, there was an uproar indeed, for Wong the Tiger, seeing what he had begun, grew reckless, and he called his soldiers and cried out,
"Clear me these courts of everyone, all these cursed sucking worms, and all their dirty women and children."
And his soldiers fell with zest to doing what he said, and the people ran out of the courts like rats from a burning house. Yes, in less than an hour there was not a soul there except Wong the Tiger and his own men, and in the magistrate's own courts the old magistrate and his lady and their few personal servants. These Wong the Tiger had commanded were not to be touched. When Wong the Tiger had done all this, and it had been done in such a burst of rage as he had seldom had in his life before, although he was given to such angers too, he went into his own room, and he sat down by the table and leaned on it, and breathed heavily for a while. And he poured himself out some tea and drank it slowly. After a time he saw that he had set a pattern for himself this day, that he must follow out somehow. But the more he thought, the more he did not regret it, for now he felt free in his heart of all his despondency and gloom, and he felt light and brave and free, and when his hair-lipped man stole in to see what he needed, and his pocked lad brought in a jug of wine for him, he cried out to them,
laughing his silent laugh as he did.
"Well, at least I have cleared out a serpent's nest this day."
When the people of that town heard of the rebellion in the court, there were many who were pleased, for they had known what corruption was there. And while some were afraid and waited to see what Wong the Tiger would do next, there were many who came clamoring about the court gates, and they cried out that there should be a time of feasting set, and that the prisoners ought to be freed out of the jail so that everyone could rejoice together. But the one who had benefited most by the uproar, and it was the poor farmer, was not among the crowd. No, although he had been delivered this once, he could not believe that any good fortune could be in store for him, and when he heard the usurer had escaped, he groaned and fled back to his land, and he went to his house and crept into his bed, and if anyone came to ask his wife or children where he was, they said he had gone away somewhere, and they did not know where he was. When Wong the Tiger heard what the people demanded, he remembered that there were in the jail some dozen or so of men whom he had seen thrown in for one unjust cause or another, and they were hopeless of coming out, for most of them were poor and had not money enough to secure their freedom. And so he was willing, and he told his trusty men to free the people in the jail, and he called out to his men that they were to have 3 days of feasting. And he sent for the cooks of the magistrate's court, and he had them come into his presence, and he said to them loudly, "Prepare the best dishes of your native parts, the hot peppery dishes and the fish dishes to go with wine, and everything with which we can make merry." He ordered good wines, too, and strings of firecrackers and rockets and all such things as pleased the people, and everyone was glad. But just before the trusty men went to fulfill his command concerning those in the jail, Wong the Tiger suddenly thought of something, and it was that woman who was in the jail, too. He had wanted her out a score of times during this winter, but each time he had not known what to do with her either. So he had contented himself with commanding that she be well fed and not chained as some were. Now when he thought of the prisoners free, he thought of her, and he thought to himself, "But how can I free her?" And he wanted her free, and yet he wanted her not so free that she could go away. And he was astonished at himself when he found he cared whether she came or went. He was astonished at his own heart, and being bewildered, he called his hair-lipped, trusty man secretly into the room where he slept, and he said, "But what of that woman we had from the lair?" Then the trusty man answered gravely, "Yes, there is she, and I wish you would let me tell the pig butcher to put a knife to her throat in a way he has, so that little blood flows." But Wong the Tiger looked away, and he said slowly, "She is only a woman." And he waited a while and said, "At least I will see her again, and then I can know what I ought to do." The trusty man looked very downcast at this, but he said nothing and went away. And as he went, Wong the Tiger called after him that the woman was to be brought at once to him in the Hall of Justice, where he would go to wait for her. He went into the Hall of Justice then and stepped up on the dais into the old magistrate's seat out of some strange impulse of vanity he had. And he thought he would like to have the woman see him there in the great carven seat raised as it was above the other seats. And there was no one to say him nay, for the magistrate did not come out of his own rooms yet, having sent word he was ill of a flux. There Wong the Tiger sat very stiff and haughty, and he kept his face smooth and proud as a hero's ought to be. At last she came in between two guards, and she wore a plain cotton coat and trousers of some dull blue common stuff. But this common garb was not what had changed her. She had eaten well, and the gauntness of her body was changed to a fullness that was still slender. Pretty she could never be because her face was too marked for prettiness, but she was very bold and beautiful. She came in steadily and freely, and she stood before Wong the Tiger, quiet and waiting. He looked at her in greatest astonishment, for he had not dreamed of a change like this, and he said to the guards, "Why is she so still now, seeing how mad she was before?" And they shook their heads and moved their shoulders and said, "We do not know, except that when she went out from our captain last time, she went broken and weak, as though some evil spirit had passed from her, and she has been like this ever since."
"Why did you not tell me?" said Wong the Tiger in a low voice. "I would have had her freed."
The guards were astonished at this, and they said to excuse themselves, "Sir, how could we know that our general cared what came to her? We waited for your commands." Then words flew of their own accord to the tip of Wong the Tiger's tongue.